Testing. Testing. Good morning.
Good morning.
Testing. As well get started. Let me begin by indicating that today is Thursday, April 2nd, 1992. And this is Jim Boning talking to Paul Cook in San Carlos. Is that where we are?
We're in San Carlos, California.
Okay. I know you were born on April 25th, 1924 in Ridgeway, New Jersey.
That's correct.
Could you tell me something about your parents and your family background?
Yeah. Ridgewood, New Jersey is a bedroom community for New York City. And perhaps 12 miles from the George Washington Bridge. So I was born there, as you say, on the 25th of April, 1924. My father was a mechanical engineer and a businessman, graduated from the Stevens Institute of Technology in Hoboken, New Jersey, and at that time one of the best mechanical engineering schools in the country. And he was an outstanding mechanical engineer. Started a business with three college friends of his, and I believe the business was started in about 1924, about the year I was born. Prior to that, in addition to being a mechanical engineer and practicing mechanical engineering some in his early life, his father had been a patent agent in Washington, D.C., and my father became proficient in the world of patents by working for his father and along with his two brothers. So he learned a great deal about the field of U.S. patent law, and even, I think, for a year, was a patent agent, not a patent lawyer, but a patent agent, and thereby learned a fair amount about patents, which played a very important part later in my career. He started this business in Paterson, New Jersey, with three college mates. The name of the company was the Cornish Wire Company, and my father was president of the company, but also was the chief mechanical engineer and the chief designer of all the machinery and the chief builder of all the machinery. And so he was a practicing mechanical engineer, but with a strong business background. And so in my early career, I was exposed to technology and math and mechanical engineering and such. And that had obviously a major impact on my life. My mother was the opposite in terms of her interest. She was very interested in music, very interested in art, had been a nurse, was a bundle of energy, and took care of her four children, which she carefully spaced in terms of family planning to be at least 3 or 4 years apart in age so that she'd have a chance to spend more time with each one in order to allow the development of their interests and skills. My brother was 7 years older than I, my older sister was 4 years older, and I'm the third, and then my younger sister was 6 years younger than I, so the family in terms of ages were well spread out. My mother was tireless in terms of supporting all of us and allowing us to develop whatever interests we had, although strongly encouraging us to be interested in music and art and that part of the world, whereas my father's stimulation was in the world of technology, engineering, and science. So it was an interesting combination of influences on me that I believe had a very positive effect on my later life. Went to public school.
In Paterson or
Ridgewood? In Ridgewood, New Jersey. Paterson was 5 miles away, very close. But went through grammar school, went through what was called junior high school, 7th, 8th, and 9th grades, and then through the Ridgewood High School. During those early years, I had a wide variety of interests, studied astronomy in some detail, built a 6-inch reflecting telescope myself, ground the mirror, and that was a major interest for a while. Photography was a major interest for a while. I started a chemistry laboratory in the cellar of our house when I was about 12 years old and developed it into a very wonderful chemistry laboratory facility. And again, with the help of my mother, was able to acquire things that would not normally be available to a 12 or 14 year old boy. She used to go to New York City with me, and we'd go to the chemical supply house named as Eimer and Ammon.
Oh, yes.
And I'd give her a list of chemicals that she would have to buy that they wouldn't sell to an underage person. And if she ever knew what she was buying, it would have been a disaster, because such things as picric acid, I remember, were one of the things that I acquired. And I used them to make bombs and explosives and all sorts of things. But she was cooperative and helpful, and I was pretty conservative in terms of being careful. And I never had any serious accidents, although there were many fun accidents. So anyhow, the main point is that my mother supported my interests strongly, whether they be in the world of science or in the world of arts, and I can't say how much of an impact that had on me in terms of allowing me to explore and develop skills, interests, and talents. Graduated from the Ridgewood High School. I played football, incidentally, in sports were important to me, and I lettered in high school in football, played in the high school band, played in the high school orchestra, was head of the bowling league, did all sorts of things like that that were important. I was a good swimmer. I even was a lifeguard one summer. I worked throughout all of my early days on vacations, and especially in the summertime. I worked as a draftsman, worked as a machinist. I worked as I pumped gas, worked in an ice cream parlor. I did a wide variety of things, always earning money and build up some capital so that I could even buy a car and do things like that.
You were very young when the Depression came, but I was wondering what effect that may have had on your family.
It meant that we had to be very careful about the money we spent, but my father's business survived through the Depression, and although it was very difficult, through the ingenuity he had as a mechanical engineer, the company was able to have relatively low costs in its processing, and so succeeded in a modest way. It never became a very large business, but it was doing in those days $2 or $3 million per year, and that was enough to have and very modestly profitable or small losses during some of the bad Depression years, but they were able to keep it together, and it continued to succeed.
Did you have any teachers in high school or elementary school? You certainly were getting enough influence in your parents, but I wondered about teachers that may have also influenced you.
Yeah, there were several teachers in junior high and high school, well, even in grammar school, that had major impacts on me that helped stimulate my interests, particularly in the world of science and technology, that happened even as early as the grammar school years. But the ones that I remember in particular were the mathematics teachers. There was one teacher that was so good and so strong that I personally worked for him to give me a chance to get more exposure to him, helped him build, remodel his house and did things like that. The physics professor in high school was particularly strong and helped again develop my interest and allowed me to go much further than just the high school physics would allow by doing outside and extracurricular work. Same thing with the chemistry teacher in high school. So those interests and this public high school was an outstanding public high school. For example, I got into MIT even without examinations because the school's record had been so strong at MIT. So very, very good teachers, very big impact on my life. And I had difficulty deciding what school I wanted to go to. My first selection really was Caltech. And the problem with Caltech was that it was so far away that the expense of transportation would have been such that it would have been prohibitive, my family felt, for me to go there. So I decided to go to MIT as the second choice and was delighted, of course, with the result.
Did you have any help in selecting Caltech or MIT as potential schools?
Not really.
I
did that pretty much on my own by studying all the schools. I had some pressure on me from relatives that I ought to go to an Ivy League school to get better rounded, unquote. But my interests were so strong in technology that I wanted to go to a technical school, and really the only two that I seriously considered were Caltech and MIT. And as I mentioned, got into MIT without any difficulty.
What year was that? I'm not clear.
I graduated from high school in 1941, when I was just barely 17. I skipped a grade in the younger, in my grammar school period. And so I entered MIT in the fall of 1941 in the class of 1945. Spent 2 years at MIT. Of course, World War II came along in December of 1941. And so I was there during the first years of the war. I enlisted in the Army. In the Army. In the second year of my college career, and they didn't take us until the end of the second year. So I went into the Army in June of 1943, was sent to North Camp Hood in Texas for basic infantry training for 13 weeks, and then was put in what was called the Army Specialized Training Program, the ASTP, that they put college kids in. And the ASTP, in turn, sent me to Stanford University. And I was sent to Stanford for 2 terms, or 6 months, and while in the Army. And whereas at MIT, I had elected to study chemical engineering, at Stanford, they put me in the mechanical engineering course. I got 2 terms of schooling in at Stanford during World War II in mechanical engineering, and thoroughly enjoyed the experience at Stanford and got to know California, especially Northern California, and resolved that someday I'd come back to Northern California. And it took only a few years to do so. After the 2 terms at Stanford, when incidentally my impression of Stanford at that time was that it was a lot easier and more fun school than MIT. Didn't have the pressure that MIT had in terms of training the mind for the high pressure, rapid decision, prodigious output that you have to have while going through MIT, at least during the first 2 years, as I remember it.
Why did you select chemical engineering?
I was influenced by some counselors in high school. As you know, chemistry was a very, very interesting to me. I did a lot of work in chemistry. But the combination of my interests in business and in engineering combined with chemistry led to chemical engineering as the thing that I wanted to study. And strangely enough, what I wanted to do at MIT was to pick a department that I felt had the most outstanding professors in it, because I felt that training of the mind was more important than any factual content that you'd learn in school. And I continue to believe that that's true, that college is a technique for training the mind and developing the mental agility and skills and intellectual strengths, as opposed to any particular factual matter, until you decide what kind of a long-term pursuit you want to have. And I wasn't sure what I wanted to do long-term. I had a conflict of, did I want to be a technologist or did I want to be a businessman? And I've never resolved that conflict. And I've enjoyed both to a very tremendous extent.
Could we talk a little bit about those first two years at MIT before we get to your Army experience?
Yeah, the first 2 years were thrilling and exciting to me because all of a sudden, having gone from an easy high school where I really didn't get pushed hard at all, I went into an arena where the competition was tough, where the number of hours that you had to put in to do the homework, et cetera, was prodigious. And so it was a total, complete change in lifestyle where my mental motor had to speed up several times compared to what it had been so far. So it was a thrilling experience. I learned what I had learned in high school, some interesting stories. I realized that that high school was not as profound as I had thought it was when I was in high school. One example, while in high school I was a member of a mathematics team, and we would compete against other schools and in various competitions, and our school was rated number 2 in the state of New Jersey, so we did very well. But we got involved in a competition in New York, which was held at NYU, and I think we were one of 50 high schools that competed. And although we were the second strongest in New Jersey, it was clear that our mathematics skills and training was subpar compared to any of the New York schools that had specialties in mathematics, because I think we placed something like 37th in the competition. And it was a good lesson to learn that you may think that you're pretty good, but there's always somebody that does a hell of a lot better. And it was a good lesson. In the first 2 years at MIT, I was stimulated by several people. Had the chance to attend lectures that were not in the courses that I was taking, but I was particularly interested in getting to know Warren K. Lewis, and went and sat in his lectures. There were some famous physicists there also that would give lecture courses, and I'd sit in on those because they were so stimulating to me. But with the war coming along, the interest in academics in the second half of my second year tapered off some, as I anticipated going into the Army, and spent a fair amount of time in the world of music. I used to go over and hear the Boston Symphony rehearsals, which you could get into for practically nothing, and used to listen to Koussevitzky and the training of the Boston Symphony, which was a great thrill for me. I also, in the first 2 years, lettered in hockey, ice hockey, and I lettered in lacrosse. So I played a fair amount of sports in college as well. Went into the Army in 1943, as I mentioned, in June. Was sent to Texas, as I mentioned, for basic infantry training. That was, I was in good shape, having been an athlete, but even for me, that was a difficult period because it went from the moderate climate of New England to the intensely hot climate of Texas early in July. And to go through infantry training at that time resulted in our company, a company consists of 225 people or so, we had seven people die of heat exhaustion or heat prostration during the first 2 or 3 weeks of training in this brand new camp that had been opened called North Camp Hood, adjacent to Fort Hood. So that was difficult, but excellent training. The Army is a lot of hurry up and wait. My patience was tested a lot in not doing things, especially coming out of an academic environment where the output per minute is so important and so precious. So that was difficult for me. I adjusted to it, however, was delighted to get to the Stanford for two terms, but then they terminated the ASTP because they needed people in the Army, that so many were being killed, and so I was sent to maneuvers in California with the 71st Light Infantry Division down in the Hunter Liggett Reservation. From there was sent back to Fort Benning, Georgia, with my division. I was selected as everybody over 6 feet in our particular regiment was put into the MPs and given the assignment of being an MP in the Fort Benning, Georgia area. Fort Benning is just across the river from a city in Alabama called Phenix City, which was Sin City, USA at that time, and every night we would be on parole duty. There'd be somebody killed or shot, or there'd be some kind of a very difficult situation that we would have to break up raids or break up fights and do all sorts of things like that. So that had an important impact on my later life as well. Any reason for pointing out some of these things is to show the wide diversity of human experience that I had in my early life, because I believe that led in many ways to a leadership capability that that later became very important to me as I led in the development of a company and knew an awful lot about interrelationships of human beings, and my experience in the Army was fundamental to my development in that area. I was not what I would call an outgoing person. I was more of a private technical person. I wouldn't call me a nerd, but at least I was a pretty private and introverted person until some of these experiences in the Army brought about some significant changes. While at Fort Benning, I applied for and was admitted to the Officer Candidate School, OCS, and went through the Fort Benning OCS Infantry Training Program, a 17-week program, the result of which I came out as a second lieutenant, was sent to Camp Croft, South Carolina for a couple of months, at which time I was then sent to Italy, where I joined the 10th Mountain Division. And fought in Italy with the 10th Mountain Division. Again, this had a very major impact on my development and on my life. Obviously, as a, 1944 is when I became a second lieutenant, so I was 20 years old and then went to Italy late 44 and joined the 10th Mountain Division and fought in the late 44 early, of course, 1945 until the war was over. War was over on May 2nd in Italy, a little before the war in Europe, almost a week before it was over in Europe. I remember we crossed the Po River on my birthday when I was 21 years old, so that was a significant day in our history, and the war was over 7 days, 7 or 8 days after that. My combat experience, although relatively short, again had a big impact on my life because as a second lieutenant I was a platoon head, and we fought in the mountains and then broke out of the Apennines into the Po Valley and then went very quickly up into the Alps. So we were just entering the Alps when the Germans gave up in Italy. And so from the 2nd of May, for the next several weeks, I had a chance to, since I had a Jeep of my own, to wander around the northern part of Italy and up into Austria, and got to know the Dolomites and that part of the world quite well, an area that I have returned to many times over the last 40 years. Big impact on me from the Army. Became a platoon leader, later became a first lieutenant, and so had a chance again to observe my skills in handling people and adjust them so that I could affect, through leadership, the performance of a series of people. That became particularly important to me at a later date, but I believe today that my experience in the Army had more to do with my development as a leader and a manager than any other experience that I went through. It's a kind of on-the-job training, you might say. And after the war was over, I had a great experience in Italy, having freedom to go many different places for the 3 months before we were deployed back to the U.S. I ran the regiment's newspaper. I ran the a school that we set up to allow the soldiers to go to school for education, and taught such varied things as mathematics and chemistry and even applied psychology by reading a book ahead of time and staying ahead of everybody by a lesson or two. But it was a chance to see education firsthand, and got a tremendous response from the soldiers, who just were so eager for education and training.
When you made the decision to enlist, why did you pick the Army? Was drafting inevitable at that point?
Being drafted was pretty much inevitable. I wanted to serve. I felt it was the right thing to do. I could have gotten out of it. A lot of the people went into the Navy V-12 program, where they were pretty well assured of staying at MIT. My conscience pulled at me quite a bit, and I felt that it would be proper for me to go in and serve in the Army. I didn't anticipate the ASTP program would send me to a place like Stanford, of course, and in retrospect that was a wonderful thing. But although I don't know that I would select it or advise it for any kid, the experience of having fought in the Army, I was lucky enough so that it was short enough so that I didn't become as bitter as many did, but it was a human experience that had a major impact on me, and strangely enough, I'd said it did me a lot of good. It made a better human being of me by a lot.
Actual combat that you see, then you must have had quite a bit.
Just a few months. No, it was relatively, and I was head of what was called the anti-tank platoon of the 2nd Battalion of the 85th Regiment of the 10th Mountain Division. So we had a 50 caliber water-cooled machine gun, which was our anti-tank weapon, and it was used for lots of purposes, hardly any tank purposes, because we never fought in the flat, and so tanks could never go any place where we were fighting. But the 50 caliber machine gun was a very key part of our mountain warfare, and a very important weapon. End of the war, in Italy, served there 3 months, moved us around. We were at Lago di Garda when the war ended. We were moved to the east border between Italy and Yugoslavia, the Isonzo River Valley, and did some patrolling there. There was continued fighting in Yugoslavia at that time, and we had to monitor and control that. In addition, a lot of us went into Austria and processed a lot of the German soldiers for demilitarizing their people. The division returned to New York in August of 1945. It was the plan of the Army to redeploy us to Japan. The Japanese War was still going on, of course. We arrived, steamed up the Hudson River, I believe it was the 2nd of August, which was unofficial VJ Day, and we got off the boat and ran into New York City and celebrated with everybody the unofficial VJ Day. I think the official VJ Day, when the Japanese finally signed and stuff, was the 2nd of September, but whatever the date was, the unofficial VJ Day was a very big day, because at that time I was given 30 days off of leave, and so had a chance to resume what amounted to civilian life. I was married on the 2nd of September 1945 to a girl that I had met at MIT, and then we were assigned to Camp Carson in Colorado. And at that time, since the war was over and we knew that we weren't going to be redeployed to Japan, and we were given an extra 15 days, so we in essence had a fabulous vacation in the Colorado Springs area of Colorado. Was then sent to Camp Swift, Texas, because I had not been in the Army long enough to get out that quickly. At Camp Swift, Texas, had a wonderful experience where, again, I was put in charge of running an Army education unit for the soldiers. My wife and I lived in Austin, Texas, and I got to know quite a few people, professors at the University of Texas at that time. In particular, one, an art historian who was a young professor that my wife and I got to know quite well, and who later played a very important part in my life in terms of our interest in art, and I'll get back to that before the story is over. Incidentally, an aside, how long do you want to do this?
It's up to you.
You want to take a break every hour or something like that?
You can do whatever you wish.
Okay, let's continue for a while, and then I'll probably be tired of talking, and we'll go from there.
Okay.
At Camp Swift, again, I was able to arrange with the University of Texas a chance for our students at Camp Swift to attend some of the lecture courses at the University of Texas, and took advantage of that. They were very kind to us and allowed that type of exchange, and in so doing got back into the world of the universities and had a chance to expose myself to some other disciplines. In particular, psychology was a subject that I was interested in at that time, along with science and engineering. But that didn't last long, and I got out of the Army in January of 1946. I guess it was February of 1946, too late to get into the current term at MIT, and so went to work for Submarine Signal in Boston for a few months, waiting for the summer term, at which time I went back to MIT. And in for the last 2 years of my undergraduate work, I actually did it in three terms by taking an extra load and by getting credit for some of the courses, not all, but for some of the courses that I took at Stanford. There were some mechanical engineering courses that were transferable to MIT for credit. So as opposed to having two full more years, I was able to graduate from MIT in three more terms by taking a tough load and getting through pretty quickly. That was 1947.
What was the chem engineering department like when you were there?
It was superb. The chemical engineering department during World War II had an awful lot to do with the synthetic rubber program. Warren K. Lewis, of course, and Ed Gilliland both were very important stars in that whole wartime effort, and they became very, very important professors for me. Warren K. Lewis had a very strong impact on me. He was a riot. A lot of us in the class, of course, were veterans, and having fought a war, we weren't particularly affected by people, and Lewis would come into class, and he enjoyed the exchange with the veterans, and especially the bright ones, and he always came into class a couple minutes late, and he came in with those glaring eyes that he had, and his fiery eyes, and he'd look around the room, and he always carried a whole bunch of books, and he'd slam the books down on his desk, and he'd pick on me as often as anybody, and he'd always save up a tough question that could be answered only if you'd done the proper preparation for the class. But he'd slam the books on the desk, and he'd just as likely say, "Cook, you horse's ass, what's the answer to this question?" And most of the people in the class would cringe and dissolve into a corner, but it was a fun experience for me because I'd stand up and shout right back at him and give him one answer I could. But it was an interesting and fun exchange. But Warren K. had a major impact on me, and I spent a fair amount of time with him after I got to know him outside of the class. Ed Gilliland had an equal impact on me, and in many ways Gilliland was more important to me because his sensitivity and knowledge of physical chemistry, something that I was particularly interested in, and its application to chemical engineering, was particularly important to me, and so I got a lot from Gilliland, and always stayed in touch with him long after I left MIT and even after I'd left the East Coast.
What kind of laboratory experience did you have? Did you get much practical?
As an undergraduate, they did have a thesis program, an undergraduate thesis program, which now is MIT-wide. The Europe program is a very, very well-known and popular program. But this was the beginning of undergraduate theses, and I did a thesis on laboratory work on the hydrolysis of, well, let's see, what did I do? I did a high-pressure electro-dissolution of water into hydrogen and oxygen and measured the efficiency at high pressures as compared to the electrolysis at atmospheric pressure. And there's a surprising increase in efficiency when you electrolyze water under pressure. And so that gave me a chance to interface with Gilliland in some detail and wrote a very modest undergraduate thesis. But that was a chance to do some original laboratory work, albeit the idea came from somebody other than me, but it was a fun thing to do. I considered going on to graduate school. I considered also going to business school. Harvard Business School was something that I thought about. But I had an opportunity to start a business with my brother, supported by my father, and so left school when I concluded my undergraduate work in June of 1947, and became the president of and the operating head of this company, which was called Warren Wire Company, that my brother and my older brother and my father had figured out was a good opportunity, and went to Williamstown, Massachusetts, where this business had started, which was adjacent to a plant that my father's company had there, and in which my brother was running. My brother, my older brother, 7 years older, John, was operating this business as the head of this factory of the Cornish Wire Company in Williamstown, Massachusetts, one of the two factories that the company had. And I ran this little startup company called Warren Wire Company to make enameled wire, make magnet wire, which in essence is processing bare copper wire through an enamel bath and then heating it and driving off the solvent and curing the enamel on the wire to make a very thin wall magnet wire, which is used to wind for transformers and motors, etc. Why don't we stop there for a minute and I'll replenish my coffee.
What was your brother's background?
My brother, who was 7 years older than I, also went to MIT, was a mechanical engineer, was more of an extrovert than I, was more of a social light than I, and was interested in business and management more than technology and science. So we differed a little that way, but he was a very capable as I mentioned, more extroverted than I, and had an interesting career. He was in the Army in World War II as a captain in the Signal Corps and was involved in Signal Corps procurement activities. So, let's see, my older sister was a secretary, and she went to Catherine Gibbs in Boston, and my younger sister, with my support and encouragement, came and went to Stanford University. So that was the rest of my family. There was enough difference in age between my brother and I that I really didn't have a lot of interface with him until when we went into this business after World War II. As I mentioned, the name of the company was Warren Wire Company, and it was established in Williamstown, Massachusetts, where I ran the company and developed and worked out the processes and that type of thing. But my brother and I did not get along. I didn't respect a lot of the things that he wanted to do, and so after a year and a half of running this business, I had a chance to join a friend that I had met at the radiation laboratory at MIT in post World War II in 1947, a man named Ralph Krauss, who was associate director of the radiation lab. And I should point out that the girl I married had been working at the radiation lab at MIT in World War II, and when I got out of the when I got back from Europe, married her, and she continued to work at the radiation lab while I was going through school. She and the government put me through the rest of MIT. But this man's name was Ralph Krauss, and he had a very big impact on my life. He and Gerald Zacharias, a very well-known professor at MIT, physics professor at MIT at that time, were important people to impact my life. Ralph Krauss went out and became the director of research of what was then called the Stanford Research Institute, which was really just getting started in 1948. I think he came to California and joined SRI in the early part of 48. And he knew I was having conflict with my brother, and also knew that, and urged me strongly to get more industrial research, to get some industrial research experience, and offered me a job to come and join the Stanford Research Institute as a chemical engineer. And I accepted that and left my brother, because my brother had arranged to leave my father's company and take over at the time that I decided I was going to leave the Warren Moore Company. So I left, came to the West Coast, joined the Stanford Research Institute as the 48th employee, Ralph Krauss, who had urged me and to come out and follow him, I think had been there as the 25th employee or something like that. Jesse Hobson was the director of SRI, and another man that had an important impact on my life, somebody that supported me strongly. But anyhow, I came and joined the Stanford Research Institute, arriving in California on Election Day of 1948, when the Chicago Tribune announced that Dewey had beaten Truman, and it wasn't until like 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning that the final California results finally were tabulated, and therefore it was concluded that, in fact, Truman beat Dewey in one of the closest presidential elections this country's ever had. It was an interesting time.
What was your first assignment at SRI?
Well, I had a series of assignments. One that involved the fluidization of sawdust to drive out the water and to, in essence, make charcoal of the sawdust in an oxygen-limited fluidized bed arrangement. I had another assignment, which was taking some scientific results at the Carnegie Institution of Washington Laboratories facility at Stanford, as supported by Carnegie, to see if the growth of the algae chlorella could be made into an industrial process. The Vannevar Bush, as head of Carnegie, had wondered, since the scientists had been able to grow chlorella so rapidly, and since it had such a high protein content, he wanted it studied to see if it could be made into a, in essence, a forced continuous process growth for the production of food. And that was a fascinating project for me. I was made head of that project team, or no, I wasn't initially. I was later made head of the project because of what they felt was some very excellent work that I had done. And we developed a continuous process for growing the chlorella, measured the results, how much light conversion could take place in the photosynthetic process, controlling the variables of temperature, of light, of density, et cetera, et cetera. And then we built a larger, in essence, sub-pilot plant to grow massive quantities of chlorella, and that then the chlorella in turn was used for feeding rats and a nutrition determination of the algae. And I received a patent on the process. So it was an interesting project as well. That's hardly what you'd call industrial research, but it was something that that I was put on and which I thoroughly enjoyed and took a year and a half or so of my time.
You had a paper in industrial engineering chemistry on that process, too.
Yes, and a paper to the American Phycological Society, as a matter of fact, as well. A pretty obscure part of science. But I enjoyed that because of the interchange with the scientists, not only Dr. Spohr and Milner at Carnegie Institute at Stanford, but all of the people involved in that science. And I enjoyed that thoroughly because of the scientific work that they were doing. And they, in turn, I think, enjoyed their relationship with me because of the engineering and technology approach that I was using. But the important assignment that I then received at SRI was heading up a combined economics and technology study for the as sponsored by the Atomic Energy Commission to determine potential uses of waste fission products. What possible commercial applications could be found by the product of nuclear reactor operation, the creation of the very troublesome fission products. And that assignment ultimately led to what has been my whole life's career. But in doing the work for the Atomic Energy Commission, we had to understand what the waste fission products were, what separating them could do, doing the chemical separations into their elemental parts is one of the things that we looked at. We looked at using the waste fission products concentrated, but used together as a whole. But the main study, of course, was what could be done with using the radiation from the waste fission products. What were the potential industrial applications for radiation, for ionizing radiation? The fission products, of course, being alpha emitters, beta emitters, as well as gamma ray producers, led to the study of all of those. There were some alpha emitters in there which could be separated out. There were certainly beta emitters that could be separated out. And obviously a huge producer of gamma rays, cesium-137 being probably the most dominant. The study went on for quite some time. We became very expert in the field. I had to learn a new science, which I had not known a lot about, so it was the research into a new field that then had to be looked at from the standpoint of practical and commercial potential.
How many people were working in this group?
Well, let's see. I think there were two people doing the economics part of it, and I was the only one doing the technical part of it. And it involved extensive travel to all of the AEC installations throughout the United States, whether it be Oak Ridge or Brookhaven or Hanford or Idaho for the reactor station there. And it gave me an exposure to a large number of people that had worked in the field of fission. The study concluded with a recommendation, which was an interesting one. The study we concluded showed that there were indeed important potential commercial applications for ionizing radiation, but it was at that time that high voltage engineering had developed the Van de Graaff generator, and at the same time the General Electric Company had taken their X-ray machine and had made an electron beam generator out of it, and so the conclusion of the study was that there were indeed important applications for radiation, but the best source of the radiation were going to be machines, not waste fish and products. The expense of concentrating the fission products and then packaging them was so expensive that a machine that could be turned on and off and powered by electricity was a very attractive way indeed. And so the result of that study was of substantial interest in encouraging me to begin to look for industrial applications for ionizing radiation. As a result of that, I promoted at Stanford Research Institute the establishment of a radiation laboratory to study potential industrial applications, and was made the head of what was called the Radiation Engineering Laboratory. And we acquired a large cobalt-60 source, created a sizable swimming pool type of shielding so that the work could be done, the experimental work could be done underwater in a variety of experimental chambers to allow the impact of the gamma rays emitting from the cobalt 60 at quite high intensities into the primarily chemical experiments. But we did sterilization of foods, but more importantly we did chemical reactions. At that same time, in the 1950-51 time frame, while the work was going on radiation, I decided that with some friends of mine at SRI, I would start a company, and asked for and received permission from SRI to carry out a nighttime weekend business operation to make an electronic hookup wire. So in 1951, a company called Sequoia Process Corporation was founded, and it was initially founded to do the production of some chemicals, but quickly changed because of my knowledge of the market for wire and cable through experience with my father's company and the experience with my brother, and decided to acquire and buy an extruder, and to purchase tin copper conductors and extrude polyvinyl chloride insulation onto those with a nylon jacket, a very thin nylon outside coating for strength and abrasion resistance, and made that wire and sold it to the large aerospace companies and the electronics companies, primarily in the Los Angeles area, as hookup wire, as electronic hookup wire. I raised money for the capitalization of that company through a friend of mine that I had developed at SRI, a man named Bill Vanderbilt, a man named Bill Valentine, and Bill Valentine had supported a development of a zinc reduction process that I worked on while at SRI, and we became pretty good friends, and he He was willing to be, in essence, an early venture capitalist by supporting the formation and later expansion of the Sequoia Process Corporation, which we later renamed Sequoia Wire Company. And this was done in a little 40-foot by 40-foot Quonset hut, a 1,600-square-foot Quonset hut in Redwood City, where we installed an extruder and accessory equipment and produced wire. It became modestly successful and grew to the point where I left SRI just before my fifth anniversary there, so that would have been in 1953, and probably the latter part of it was the early part of 53 when I became a full-time CEO of the Sequoia Wire Company. And that grew and expanded, and I made the classic mistake of letting Mr. Valentine own over 50% of the company as we received more money from him to continue our expansion. And the company at that time was doing perhaps a couple of $1 million of business a year, and was, as I say, modestly profitable but growing rapidly. And after Mr. Valentine got 51% of the company, as was his right, he asked me to do some things that I didn't want to do. And so, to make a long story short, we had a serious conflict. I left the Sequoia Wire Company and started immediately thereafter Raychem Corporation, which was initially called Irradiated Products Incorporated. Later, the name was changed in the second month to Raytherm. When we selected that name, Raytheon objected to the name as being too close to them, and so we changed the name then to Raychem for radiation chemistry.
Well, there are a couple of things before we get to Raychem. You had several patents that came out of SRI of radiating polyethylene. Did they come out of SRI?
No, they did not come out of SRI. Oh. That was later.
Okay. I wasn't sure.
At SRI, the only patents that I applied for and got were on this algae process, the chlorella process.
Where does this interest in starting companies come from? Is that your father's influence?
Undoubtedly. My father's business interests, with a strong technical background, clearly emanated from my father. I was always excited to hear the conversations about business, always excited to see how technology, in fact, could be used for developing a business. And quickly also learned about patents and believed that a company doing innovative technical research could get a jump on everybody else and make a greater profit margin, particularly a greater gross profit margin, than others by being first and smarter. That's why I wanted to get more industrial research experience after I left the Warren Wire Company, and I wanted to know more about how you developed industrial processes and industrial products. And so that's what led to my joining the Stanford Research Institute. I believe that several years of experience, especially being able to see what the large companies of this country did to develop products, and I felt that SRI was a great place to do it because it would give me exposure to those companies supporting work at SRI, as well as a chance to go around and try to sell ideas to the large companies and get exposure to them that way. In fact, that worked. It was a technique that was very successful indeed, and I learned a great deal about industrial research and how it was done and who did it well and who especially capitalized on it, leading to important innovative products that carried good price-to-cost relationships, what I felt was the secret to a rapidly growing and successful company. And that turned out to be absolutely true. What I did learn at SRI was very, very productive indeed. The fact that I'd had hands-on experience running the Warren Wire Company for a year and a half was very helpful, and the experience I had developing the Sequoia Process Corporation was a very helpful experience as well. So I had lots of learning experiences but all going in the same direction of trying to get myself ready for leading an effort to industrialize high technology. I didn't consider that I was a particularly brilliant scientist, but I did have the capability of putting together technology with a marketplace, and had enough drive and intensity to be sure that a process or a product get developed quickly, efficiently, and successfully. I had lots of failures, and I happen to believe that you learn more from a failure than you do from a success, because you know what not to do the next time, and when you have a success, you're not sure whether it's luck or you're at the right place at the right time or where it came from, the proper use of resources or whatever. So I've had lots of failures in my life, and I've gained an awful lot from, I hope, from having been through them and learned what not to do the next time. Now, I've got you in the time frame of about 1953 now, where I left SRI, ran Sequoia, built it up to a company doing several million dollars of business a year, and having the fight with Valentine in 1956, late summer, and resigned and left. Took a couple of months off to go to Europe and figure out what I wanted to do next, and decided that trying to do the industrial applications of high-energy ionizing radiation was what I wanted to do.
Were your disagreements with Valentine on the technical side or on the business side?
On the business side, but revolving around technical things. I wanted to develop some products, and he didn't want me to spend any money developing those products, and they were products centered around radiation. And he felt that was a mistake and that the money shouldn't be spent on that, and that's why I left. And it was just at that time that the General Electric Company had for the first time developed what I would call an industrial electron beam generator. As I mentioned, an electron beam generator had come out of GE and high voltage engineering several years before that, but the GE, both the machines didn't have enough beam current to make a process practical. It would only allow experimental work, but not industrial processes. But it was just at that time that GE had developed a swept beam so that the electron stream could come out of the vacuum in the vacuum tube into air and would be swept in both directions over a horn at the end of this vacuum tube that was about 12 inches wide by about 3 inches, 2.5 inches wide. The titanium window being there, of course, to maintain the vacuum in the tube, but being as thin as possible and as low Z as possible, so that, first off, the least amount be converted to X-rays, and that the most energy being allowed to pass out into the air. And so GE had this swept beam, which was a 1 MeV, 1 MeV, and I think it was 6 milliamps. It was a 6 milliamp. Prior to that, the largest was 1 milliamp, or in other words, 1 kilowatt. 1 MeV at 1 milliamp. But this new one was 6 milliamps at 1 MeV, 1 million volts. And that 6 kilowatts was enough to make practical some of the processes that I had envisioned. And so I personally rented that machine, the first one that GE produced, to install as part of this new company that I was forming, the Raychem Corporation. I mortgaged my house and pulled together as much money as I could, and for $50,000 of equity money plus the personal lease of this GE electron beam generator, a resonant transformer electron beam generator. Started this company in a little building in Redwood City where we had 5,000 square feet at 2821 Fair Oaks Avenue, a building that I revisited just a few years ago on our 25th anniversary. I opened the doors of this business on the 1st of January, 1957, New Year's Day. The business was incorporated on the 15th of January, 1957. During the first year, well, incidentally, I received as our financial backing money from Ed Heller, a very famous local figure who was really the predecessor of the whole venture capital world of the San Francisco Bay Area. Ed Heller had supported some companies up until then. I had known Heller socially through various activities. He was a partner in Schwabacher and Company, but a very, very wealthy man indeed. And I went to him for support, and he had a man working for him named Larry Durig that did all of his due diligence and work. And Heller did agree to support me, and so I took two associates that I had with me at Sequoia Wire Company and brought them into this new company that subsequently became Raychem Corporation. And we proceeded to develop a series of products. We rented this GE machine, which was delivered in March of 1957. We had built a housing and shield for this machine through a very clever, inexpensive innovation. We built walls around the machine to provide the shielding, and built them out of wood and made an annulus, and then filled the annulus with sand, holding the wooden walls together with steel reinforcing rods. And the sand, of course, being the cheapest form of shielding that I could think of, and it was very effective indeed. The only problem with it was every time there was an earthquake, the sand would be compacted some, and we'd have to open up the walls and put some more sand in to make sure it was filled. It was a housing, what we call a radiation cell, that we built for something like $7,000 today to build a proper radiation shell is something like $1.5 million. So it was an innovative and inexpensive way of forming a radiation capability. During the first year, 1957, of Raychem's history, we developed five products, all of which I was the inventor of, three of which became successful, two of which did not become successful. The three products that did become successful were a flame-retarded, cross-linked polyethylene hookup wire for the wire and cable field, a high-density polyethylene foamed insulation for a coaxial cable for the military, and then thirdly, a heat-shrinkable, flame-retarded polyethylene tubing, a tubing that upon heating would recover and return to an original smaller diameter shape, and which of course was the predecessor of the whole field of heat shrinkable tubings and molded shapes and parts that are the basis for 80% of Ray Kemp's $1.3 billion per year of business even today. So that was, that first year was a very productive year in terms of the beginnings of what were an entire new industry, an industry that today is probably $5 billion a year worldwide, and one where the products of the use of radiation had originated in this tiny little building in Redwood City.
How did you, I mean, that five products in a year is pretty good. How did you get your ideas? Where did they come from?
Well, a lot of the important work, the cross-linking of polyethylene with ionizing radiation is even today argued in terms of who was the originator of that technology. A man in England named Arthur Charlesby was certainly one of the early workers. But GE and their laboratories in Schenectady, with somebody that would be familiar to many people in this country, Art Beakey, together with a guy named Elliot Lawton, did some pioneering work in using radiation to cross-link polyethylene and make a tape of it. And the tape would shrink a little bit and bond to itself and form an insulation. And GE thought this was a very important process. The combination of those things led to my originating the tubing, which would shrink. Only I made our tubing shrink about 2 to 1, whereas their tape would only shrink a small percentage. So I came up with the idea of making a tubing that would be extruded in an X diameter, then irradiated by exposing it to the high energy radiation in a special process that we developed. And then that cross-linked polyethylene tubing would be taken and heated up. And our original experiments were to, we'd put it inside a piece of pipe and used an air compressor and just blew it up by increasing the internal pressure on the tubing so it would expand against the wall of the pipe. And we'd make it in 4 or 5 foot sections, and sure enough, by heating it, it would return to its original diameter. Then one of the other original people in the company, Dick Muchmore, and I developed a process to do this by an original continuous process to expand the tubing in continuous long lengths into heat shrinkable tubing. And so that was one of the three successful products the first year. And the company, whose doors opened on the 1st of January, made its first profit in the month of August. So 8 months later, we made our first profit. In September, the beam tube of this GE resonant beam transformer busted. And for 11 weeks, we were without any radiation capacity. As the result of that, our customers whom we had developed to use this exciting new products as the result of radiation chemistry became disillusioned with the fact that they couldn't get delivery on the product. We had no income coming in as the result. The company almost went bankrupt. We had to lay off most of the people in the company at that time, and there were 17 survivors. And those 17 survivors all had to take pay cuts. I took a cut of 33%, and then we scaled down the reductions of the pay of others. But the minimum anybody got was, I think, 15%. And so for 11 weeks, we had a great problem. I guess maybe it was October when this first happened, because we got a new tube from GE about 2 weeks later and installed it, and it didn't work. We received the second tube from them, and it didn't work. And finally, I think it was the fifth tube that we finally got from GE on Christmas Eve of 1957. We found one that worked. We went back on the air. We worked throughout Christmas Day and New Year's Day and got back into production, and and barely survived. But won back the friendship of the customers that we had developed, and quickly ordered a second unit and also a couple of standby tubes, and we're in business for good.
Were you involved in the original selling? And
oh yeah, I was involved in everything. I was the chief salesman. I was the chief technologist. I was a little bit of everything. And our original sales were to people like the big initial customers were Convair, part of General Dynamics in San Diego, the General Dynamics company in Fort Worth, Texas, Lockheed in Burbank. Those were the biggest original purchasers. Joining them not too much later included Lockheed Missiles Division in Sunnyvale. And we did a lot of business both with them, with the Polaris missiles, as well as with the later the satellite business. But it was highly military, highly defense oriented, and that's because the environmental needs of military equipment were more severe than commercial, and that was an easier sale for us, because one customer would buy more product than you would in the commercial world. So we had I think something like 70% of our business the first few years was U.S. government end use type business, and we became concerned about that. Well, we even had a cancellation of the U.S. government canceled a major military program once, that the Skybolt missile that impacted us very severely and put us into a loss position for a while. And we resolved at that time that we were going to become much less dependent on military efforts, and did. So that today, something like only 10% of our business is U.S. government and use business. Now, if that, let's see, it's about, yeah, I think it's like maybe 8% today.
Do you have any competition?
Great Chem has competition today in many, many different areas. The Japanese early on picked radiation chemistry as one of the technologies that they thought was going to be important in the future, and approached us for licenses. I visited Japan and saw the companies that wanted the licenses and decided not to license. That irritated them considerably, and by that time we had built a modest patent portfolio. One of the companies, a company named Nitto, N-I-T-T-O, elected to go ahead and infringe our patents and started selling heat-shrinkable tubing in the United States, infringing one of our patents. And so we sued Nitto, and we elected to pick the venue of Texas. And since they had sold product in Texas, infringing our patent, and not only did we sue them in Texas, then we asked for a jury trial, anticipating that perhaps Texans wouldn't be too friendly towards an infringing Japanese company. And to make a long story short, that court suit was settled by Nitto withdrawing the product, and I became quite friendly with the CEO of Nitto, a man named Hijikata, and we developed a long and personal and friendly relationship as the result of our suing Nitto fairly early on. But we've had lots of competition for years, but no one company has ever done a wide variety of things with radiation such as Raychem did. We had a big lead initially in the field, and I believe strongly that as opposed to having a few products with huge markets, it would be much better to have many, many products with relatively small markets that would give us protection through our having the collective efficiency of processing many different products through the common radiation processing, and that we could run ahead of the rest of the world by so doing. And that theory proved out to be very well founded, because we had literally thousands of different products that we made by radiation processing, taking advantage of the huge capital investment and our huge knowledge and technology lead in terms of the radiation processing. Today, I think Raychem still has well over 50% of the market of all of the radiation products that it makes. And that's in spite of the fact that the Japanese have been trying, and lots of Japanese companies, I think there's something like 15 Japanese companies in the radiation processing field. And that's in spite of the fact they've been trying to do it for something well over 25 years. See, Raychem was formed in 1957, so we've been in business now for 35 years. And it's given us a remarkable lead and opportunity. It's interesting, we also felt that it was critical that we serve all of the available markets of the world as opposed to just concentrating on the U.S. So we immediately spread to Europe. We went to the Far East, and including Japan itself, so that there wouldn't be an open window through which a competitor could pass and enjoy a market unimpeded by competition. So 60% of our business is outside the U.S. and 40% in. And of that 60%, we manufacture product, in essence, where we sell it. So we've got major facilities around the world with concentrations in Germany, France, the U.K., Belgium, Denmark, Japan, Brazil, Argentina. So we're well placed and spread around the world, we take advantage of the countries where they like to buy from local sources as opposed to imports. And so we've taken advantage of that.
When you first started, you said you were involved in almost all aspects of the company. How many employees did you have initially, and how rapidly did that grow?
Well, we got up to 34 people in August of 1957 and chopped it back to 17 when we had the beam tube failure. Then it grew, in essence, it grew at 25% per year for 25 years. That was our average growth rate for that period of time. We have something like 11,000 employees around the world today, roughly 40% of them in the U.S. and 60% outside the U.S. In other words, well-balanced and well-hedged with respect to where we manufacture product and where we sell product, being equal.
I read somewhere, one of the interviews that you had done, well, there were a number of things in that interview that were interesting. You once used the term patient capital, and Willard Dow used that phrase in World War II. Dow was developing styrene process. He talked about a patient money and a prayerful attitude.
The patience that Raychem has practiced is in the development of new technology that takes patience and time to develop, but which has a major reward at the end of the patience. We didn't have any patience to begin with in the first year because we didn't have a lot of money and had to get products out and get them sold and get a quick return. But the patience was that we believed and stuck to radiation chemistry as the technology that we were expert in and wanted to become expert in and wanted to exploit through a myriad of different products. albeit all with relatively small markets, because we were afraid that if we invaded a large market, the big companies, the big chemical companies, could easily come along and do the same thing that we had done. And although we felt that patents were a good protection, we didn't feel that you could count on patents to protect yourself against the large chemical companies that would have huge amounts of money to either get around the patent or to fight the patent. And in those days, patents weren't as strong as they are today, didn't provide as much protection as they do today. That's been, in my opinion, a very happy change in the legal patent arena in the United States. But the patience required to stick with the technology and continue its development, even when you're not sure that the long term is going to be productive, is a patience that takes a fair amount of courage, and where you can make mistakes. So to have patience, I believe that you also have to have an accompanying quite high gross profit margin to allow you the freedom to make mistakes. If you're in a commodity business where the gross profit is very low, you don't have the discretion in order to make investments that go over a long period of time. So I think patience comes from high gross profit margins, just as you see in the world of semiconductors, where a company like an Intel or wherever enjoy quite attractive high gross profit margins, and that in turn allows them to put a fair amount of money into technology development. Now, let's see. I don't know how much we ought to go into some of the details of RACAM, or whether you want this to have more of a technology bent or a management bent, or
I'm interested in all those aspects. So, I was going to ask about how you hired people and what you look for in a new employee.
Well, the key to the success of any company, especially a high technology company, is in its people. And hiring people is probably the most important single criteria for a company's success, in my view. So we spent and do spend a lot of time looking for, attracting, hiring, and then training employees. And we have a very generous compensation program as well for results. One of the things that we do in terms of hiring people is that first we process potential important employees through a large number of management interviews. And in general, we'll put prospective candidates through 10 or 12 interviews, which is a big burden in terms of time. It takes a lot of time, but we found that as opposed to putting somebody through three or four interviews, going up to 10 or 12 gave us enough additional information so that by the time of the fourth or sixth or eighth interview, we'd have identified if there were some weaknesses, and we'd have a chance to penetrate those weaknesses and understand the individual that we were proposing to hire in great depth, so that we'd have very excellent feedback. And for that reason, I think we were able to create a very high quality of employees for the particular type of thing that we were looking for, and that is, of course, innovative, strong technical people that could put together a technology with a market opportunity. And so maybe your suggestion is a good one, that is a very key part of the success of a business with a high gross profit margin. It's not a commodity type business where you're trying to do the same thing everybody else does, cheaper and better. I always wanted to do things that were different, always wanted to have products that were original, always wanted to be first. I did not believe in the being second as the way to win in business, and I continue to believe that till today. That being first with a new technology, even though it takes extraordinary energy and time and resources, is the better way to go. And it's an intellectual ballgame today. The U.S. is not going to succeed in the future, in my opinion, in the commodity business, just because there's always going to be people who can become educated that will do something that's been done before faster and cheaper because they're willing to accept a lower standard of living and accept a lower pay. And that's happening in Korea, that's happening throughout the Pacific Basin. Japan is beginning to have problems themselves where Korea is making products cheaper than Japan does, and they can land steel in Tokyo cheaper than Japan can make steel in Japan, and that's inevitable. So it's an intellectual ball game in business, and if you don't continue to progress technology-wise and innovate, you're not going to be able to sustain success. And this country's problem at the moment, in my view, is that they're letting the education system fall so badly that it's endangering our whole standard of living. And that's a different subject that I'm sure we don't want to get into here, but it's one that I feel pretty strongly about.
Your key here in innovation and large number of products and smaller markets being first, how much freedom did your people have to be innovative? How did you incur
a great deal? We always had a central research facility where, in essence, we tried to penetrate the basic technology and the basic science itself, or to do research in those areas that were common to all of our divisions. So there was innovation in central research, which was more of the science and technology variety. The product innovation came out of the divisions. The divisions were responsible for developing their own products, and we did a lot of cross-fertilization by moving people back and forth between the division development areas and the central technology area, so that the information was shared and cross-fertilized everywhere. But we looked for innovative people, found innovative people, and as I said in the Harvard Business Review interview, we asked for innovation. And I happen to believe that people are basically innovative or they're not. It's something that's very difficult to teach. I think your body biology has got to be built that way. You've got to have a curiosity that makes you think about how things work and what you can do that's different and new. And when you're trying to do something different and new, you've got to wake up in the middle of the night and think about how to solve the problem. You've got to think about it at odd times, and you've got to have a drive to answer the question you're trying to answer. That's relentless. I don't think it strikes you like lightning. I think you have to really force it and push it and think about it. For that reason, I think the management of innovation requires one of encouragement, one of interest, one of support, one of congratulations and thanks for success. But the most important thing is interest. And the person who is innovating new products, I think, gets more excitement from achievement and recognition of achievement than they do from financial compensation. And I have said so many times. So the interest of management in the process becomes fundamental to success. And I claim that the manager that gets the best success is the one that continually asks his innovative people how they're doing, how their experiments are progressing, to ask questions about the magnitude of the success, the details of what they're doing. Nothing's more exciting to a developer than having somebody appreciate what they're doing, know it in considerable detail, and to follow almost on a daily basis the progress. If there's nobody doing that, somebody can lose interest and excitement, and something that would be possible to do in a week could end up taking months. And I believe that in a structured, large company environment, that's an easy thing to have take place. So the intensity of small units with a management structure that follows the success and failure is an important part of managing innovation.
Did you, I guess there are two ways of looking at it. Did you target a product or a customer and then try to find a product, or did you find a product and then try to target a customer?
Well, we were mostly a market-driven company. And obviously, we had the basis of radiation chemistry as the technology. Then the question is to go out and look for opportunities. And the most difficult people to find were people who could put together a market opportunity with a technology and come up with an innovative answer. So we looked hard and long for that type of person. I happen to be very good at that myself. I'm good at seeing a marketplace and understanding the economics of the marketplace, that is, what a product is worth to a customer, potentially, and then in turn, what can be done with the technology to produce such a product. But in general, we are a market-driven company, albeit with the basis of a sound and new technology, radiation chemistry. So we'd look at market opportunities in a wide variety of marketplaces, and we divided the marketplaces up into typical electronics versus electric energy versus telecommunications versus process industries, and then we'd organize those industry segments into divisions, market-oriented divisions, and then use that as the structure to which we would develop products, through which we would develop products. In other words, the telecommunications industry would have a series of problems that were environmental protections of telephone cables or outside telephone plant or whatever, and then we'd attack those problems with the tools that we had at hand that we had developed over the years. And that has been a very, very successful way of developing product. And those development efforts were always supported by the central technology of the company, where basic discoveries were made, where basic skills were developed, where a variety of polymers would be cross-linked and formulated and fixed to answer the environmental needs.
I believe in that Harvard Business Review interview that you also said that you basically in those early years developed all of the technology. You're still going back to that.
Yeah, it's interesting. When you get a new technology, I believe that in the first very short period of time, you can imagine most of the applications for it. I think in the first 5 years, we came up with at least the ideas of essentially everything that could be done with the technology. Obviously, we didn't have the money and the resources to do all of them or even a lot of them. But we thought about them all. And I think when you do a new technology, very quickly you can consider the applications in great detail that can be accomplished by that technology. I don't think that the semiconductor field has been doing anything that wasn't envisioned years ago. I think it might be time for another break.
Okay, that's fine. Sure.
See what's going on. The use of high-energy ionizing radiation to accomplish chemical change, of course, is the basis for RayChem 80% of what we do. The physical phenomenon of what happens is relatively simple. Most of the things that we use, most of the radiation forms that we use are, in fact, electrons, high-speed electrons. And they will range in general from a half an MeV up to perhaps 3 MeV is where most of our radiation is done. The only difference between whether it's a half an MeV or a 3 MeV affects only the penetration distance that the radiation will make. In a plastic material whose specific gravity is generally in the range of 1, whether it be polyethylene at 0.92 on up to a polyvinylidene fluoride at 1.7, it's still within a relatively narrow range. The amount of radiation, of course, in turn will determine the amount of chemical change. The beta part, the electrons penetrating a plastic, will go in and be very indiscriminate in terms of how it gives up its energy. It will sever chemical bonds and then, in essence, create free radicals. The irradiation of polyethylene is the simplest. When you bombard a polyethylene with high energy electron radiation, in essence, what you'll do is knock off hydrogen atoms and really do evolve hydrogen gas from the process. And then one molecule will join to an adjacent molecule where that hydrogen atom has been eliminated. That cross-linking is the foundation of, in essence, everything that we do. The cross-linking of plastics in the solid state, that is in the crystalline form, if it's a crystalline plastic, or in an amorphous form, if it's an amorphous plastic, is in essence what we do. And you cannot do the same thing with another process very easily. You can't do it economically. If you have a plastic material and you heat it up, obviously it melts and changes its shape or loses its shape. What we do is make a, for example, one typical one is making a tubing of a crystalline plastic, polyethylene or polyvinylidene fluoride or any one of the many, many plastics that we use. We irradiate that in its tubing form, and then by irradiating it, you cross-link it. That is, you will cause a three-dimensional network to be formed where one molecule will join together chemical bond with an adjacent molecule. The more you irradiate it, the more cross-links or chemical bonds that you form joining together in this three-dimensional network. Now, with a thermoset plastic, you'll have a cross-link every few carbon atoms. In the type of work that we do, you only have one cross-link for every 100 to 1,000 carbon atoms, depending on what type of property you're looking for. For example, when we join together adjacent molecules by cross-linking a polyethylene tubing, where we want the network to be strong enough to cause it to recover quickly and sharply, it'll require perhaps one cross-link for every 1 to 200 carbon atoms. And that, in turn, will determine how much radiation dose we give it. Now, we make a wide variety of products. As a wire and cable insulation, you want more cross-links so that you'll have more strength above the crystalline melting point. And I might just recite here how the heat recoverable plastic works, because you're talking about crystalline plastics. You cross-link them in the crystalline room temperature, in essence, form. You normally do not cross-link in the crystalline areas. You cross-link in the amorphous areas of the plastic, and those cross-links then form the three-dimensional network. When you heat up that plastic that has this network of cross-links and has a three-dimensional structure, you melt the crystals and in essence make an elastic out of it, because it is an elastomeric material in its non-crystalline heated cross-linked form. When you apply a stress to that elastic material, just like an elastic band, it will stretch. And as long as it still is heated and above the crystalline melting point, it'll act exactly as an elastomer. You stress it and it will strain. You relieve the stress and the strain will recover. Now, as I mentioned before, you adjust the cross-link network based on how much strength you want to have in the elastomeric form. Now, what we were able to accomplish even in the earliest days was to vary the cross-link density in order to accomplish the various product functions that we were after. And as I mentioned, when you have a wire and cable insulation, you're looking for a material that will be functional at high temperatures in case there's a short circuit, in case there's an excursion to high temperatures for a short period of time. So we would, for wire and cable insulations, create a fairly high cross-link network. For the heat-shrinkable tubing, it would be a lower cross-link network. Now, back to the example that if you make a tubing and cross-link it at room temperature and then heat it up, then the elastic network takes over, since the crystals have melted. You stretch the tubing, that is, you blow it up, you create a differential pressure so that the internal pressure is higher than the external pressure, and that causes the tubing to expand, and to expand in only the dimension of the diameter. The circumference will increase, but the length will not change. So the heat shrinkable tubing operates on the basis of, first you extrude a tubing and cool it so that it's crystalline, then you irradiate it, that cross-links it, then you heat it up again to melt the crystals and you have an elastomeric tubing. You put pressure on the inside of the tubing to make it expand in diameter but not change in length through a carefully monitored process. Then, while it's in the expanded form, you cool it, and that crystallizes the plastic in its expanded form. By adjusting the network, the elastomeric network, the cross links, to be weaker than the crystals will maintain that size, even though the cross links would like to return it to its original size. So then when you subsequently heat up that tubing, the crystals melt, the cross-link network takes over, and it returns it to the form in which it was originally cross-linked. And that's the process of a heat-recoverable polymeric structure. And as I mentioned, the cross-linking is done with the exposure to high-energy ionizing radiation. Now, cross-linking can be done with other techniques. You can use a peroxide to cross-link polyethylene. The difficulty with a peroxide process is that you've got to heat it up to activate the peroxide to bring about the cross-links, and that flies in the face of you're trying to keep a dimensional stable structure. So although it can be done, it's a cumbersome process, and radiation is an elegant way and a very inexpensive and economic way of bringing about the cross-linking. Additional things can be done, however, with radiation. For example, you can graft monomers onto a polymer backbone, and grafting is an elegant scientific accomplishment originally developed in France by McGaugh and Shapiro, Addie Shapiro being a close friend of mine and Ray Kems, and having worked with us for years and years and years. But grafting is a common process that uses radiation as a technique to, for example, change surface properties by grafting a monomer onto a polymer structure and creating an external surface of the polymerized monomer, having different properties than the polymer backbone. One could provide strength, another could provide a surface adhesive quality that you desire. You could take a Teflon and graft a material on the outside of the Teflon to allow adhesion to take place. You can switch them.
Okay, now we're back.
I'm not sure how much we lost, but it's not important.
You're talking about the process itself being almost perfunctory now.
The process of exposing plastic materials and polymeric and elastomeric materials to radiation is a question of passing the material through a shield into the radiation field, which is at the end of the long vacuum tube, and that process technology has developed over lots and lots of years, and there are lots of trade secrets involved with it, ways of being efficient, ways of making sure that you use as many of the electrons as you possibly can. But I was also mentioning that from a safety standpoint, that people were concerned about in the earliest days, has never been a problem. We've never had an accident, never had an over-radiation exposure problem with any of our people. Obviously, everybody is monitored with film badges. The interlocks on the doors, the safety alarms, the shutdown monitors and such have worked elegantly, and there's never been a problem. So our cautions and care that we set up even in the earliest days have always worked out to be a totally safe industry. So I'm very proud of that, and the concerns that many technical people had in the earliest days were unfounded, and we've had a totally safe and outstanding record industry. Let's see, what are areas of technology are there? The products as the result of the technology have become very sophisticated, whereas we started out with relatively simple flame-retarded antioxidant containing simple polyethylene polymers, whether they be high density or low density, whether they be the ultra-high molecular weight polyethylenes or even the simplest low-density polyethylenes. That's progressed now to areas where we have multiple layers of polymers, where each layer is irradiated at a different level to obtain a different property. For example, where we have tubings with an inner melting layer and an intermediate heat recoverable layer, and then an outside layer that will have a special adhesive property. So it's become a very sophisticated field with very elegant developments. Again, nothing that could not have been anticipated in the first few years, and in fact that we did anticipate in the first few years in terms of our brainstorming what could be done with this new technology. And although we continue to develop
lots of new products every year. It's not based on a technical capability in general that wasn't anticipated as much as 15, 20, 25 years ago. How much more is there to go in this field? How much more can be discovered? How much more product innovation can be accomplished? A great deal. A great deal. It's a field that will continue to grow at more modest rates than the 25% per year that our first 25 years resulted in, but even so, there's a good 10 or 15% per year of additional product capabilities in front of us.
Are there other applications to ionizing radiation that you use besides polymers?
Yeah, none that we at RayChem are interested in. It is certainly true that ionizing radiation can sterilize foods or pharmaceuticals. It is commonly used by, for example, Johnson & Johnson to sterilize sutures and things such as that. Food is only now really beginning to go because there's been so much concern about the byproducts of irradiation of food. A lot of people would wonder whether or not in irradiating food because of the indiscriminate chemical reactions that result from the irradiation, whether or not some of the byproducts would be carcinogens. And obviously it would take quite a lot of time to prove that they are or are not. The FDA has recently, however, approved the irradiation of several different materials, and there are some irradiated foods now that have come to market. Question is, how successful will that be? Purpose of irradiating foods is multi. They can be put in sterile packages and used for sterilization, but the most common thing is a relatively low dose to inactivate enzymes, prevent food spoilage for an extended period of time, as opposed to a totally sterile package that would last forever. So the irradiation of grains to prevent the infestation and spoilage of wheat or other grains is common. The elimination of salmonella through the irradiation of eggs or pork or whatever is another relatively low-dose procedure. And lots of concern, however, in terms of whether the public will buy something that's irradiated, and anybody that provides an irradiated food product has to advertise that it is irradiated, and it may be that there'll be enough resistance to irradiated foods. I don't know enough about the recent technology, that is, what's happened in the last 20 or 25 years in the irradiation of foods, to be very knowledgeable about it, and so I don't even have an opinion on whether it's good, bad, or indifferent. But I do know that there's a fair amount of work being done on it. Other areas for the use of radiation, as I mentioned before, in addition to cross-linking, it can be used for grafting. The other big application for radiation for heat shrinkable materials is what W.R. Grace does for their Cryovac heat shrinkable food packaging and bubble packaging with heat shrinkable clear sheet material. Big bags or sheets that shrink upon heating, and they've made a big business out of that. Our business is something over $1 billion a year in radiation. Their business is about the same size. The original work of W.R. Grace was done at RayChem. And I knew Brad Dewey, the head of Cryovac, who later sold out to W.R. Grace, and his first lieutenant, technical lieutenant, Bill Baird. And they used our first radiation unit to do their original work for making heat shrinkable plastic packages, and we had a close and good relationship for a long number of years. And Cryovac's business has been a very successful one. We've not been interested in that because that's an entirely different field than we're in. Fortunately, they haven't been interested in the electrical insulation field, which is primarily what we're involved in, and so we've both gone our own directions, although we've shared common technology for these many, many years. I think they went into business with radiation, with radiated materials, 2 or 3 years after we did, so it's been an interesting U.S. development and a very successful United States technology development.
Do you build your own sources and units?
No, we do not. We maintain them and modify them and such, but we've always purchased our units from suppliers, the original one being GE, as I mentioned already. Radiation Dynamics is a company in Long Island that struggled and made what's called the Dynamitron. That company has in the last few years been bought by a Japanese company, and the Japanese continue to maintain them, and we continue to buy our materials from RDI, as it's called, Radiation Dynamics Incorporated.
I can see how you can irradiate something on a small scale, but how do you do this when you're doing large scale product formation?
It's not difficult. You just have a transportation system, a transport that will take large product in and out of the chamber, and you can do it through a maze. Obviously, radiation passing in a straight line and won't turn corners, so all you have to do is create a maze that the product can go in and out of the chamber, and it's that simple. So it's not a complicated thing. Obviously, the radiation will cover larger areas the longer distance from the source you are. So if you got a really big product, you got a long ways away from the source. So there's nothing difficult or magic about that. Obviously, again, idiosyncrasies that go along with the field and lots of trade secrets that you develop as you bump into practical problems and solve them. But it's a straightforward, relatively easy practice. The irradiation of air produces ozone, and the ozone has to be properly evacuated. I guess with the concern about the ozone layer, we may have to produce ozone, and this is a good way of doing it. But we've eliminated ozone through scrubbing the air, and ozone, of course, in concentrated amounts would be quite harmful.
You expanded overseas very early.
Yeah, we moved to the UK and to Germany in about our fifth year in business. And we had a major thrust of development in Europe and established ourselves there as the dominant person in our field there early on, and that's been very successful. We stayed away from Japan on purpose for a lot of years because of their interest and dedication to radiation, but then decided that we'd better be there to see what they're doing and also to make sure that we participated in any rapid growth and especially profitable markets. And so that's worked well as well. I think that's probably good enough for first session. And what I've forgotten, I don't know, but we may take a look at what the product is and then figure out how we go from there.
Oh, sure. I appreciate your taking your time this morning to
talk with me. I didn't know exactly what to anticipate, but